supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The ancient Greeks and Romans believed that creativity was a gift from the gods, that it didn't come from inside of us. We're simply a voice. Interestingly, many creative people write, paint, perform from the parts of their lives that have been broken open. Thanks, gods. And it's that brokenness that's often the birthplace of creative genius. On today's show, we'll take a look at the creative process. What is it? What helps it along? What gets in the way of it, like procrastination, addiction, depression? So joining us to talk about this and so much more is Barry Panter, Rachel Simon, and Andrew Schaefer. Barry Panter is a psychiatrist and founder of Creativity and Madness Conference. He's co-author of Creativity and Madness Volumes 1 and 2, and he joins us by phone. He's traveling out west. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And where are you at the moment?
Well, I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Not bad. Could be worse. I'm also joined here in the studio by Rachel Simon. She's the award-winning author of 6 books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Story of Beautiful Girl. She's with me here in the studio. Welcome back to the show, my dear friend.
Hi, Dan. Great to be here.
And humorist Andrew Schaefer. He's the author of Literary Rogues, a scandalous history of wayward authors. We have him by phone. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me on, Dan.
And we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you are one of those creative types, or you fancy yourself a creative type, where does that come from? What actually is that to you? 888-477-9499. Well, the three of you, this is a very creative group, and I'd like to hear a bit about your creative process, each of you. What do you know about it? What remains a mystery? Rachel, I want to start with you. On Facebook this weekend, you said it was your first venture outside of your writing bubble.
Yeah.
Tell us about your writing bubble.
Well, I should preface this by saying each book I've written, it's a slightly different process. So, however, the writing bubble does seem to go from book to book. I pretty much write in isolation. I don't tell people what I'm writing. I don't show people what I'm doing. And the more I work on a project, the bigger and bigger the bubble becomes. I kind of think of it like a tent that grows larger and larger as it gets more and more populated by my characters, whether they're real or fictional. And eventually, when everything gets in order and I've got the whole story in place and I've got the words in place, then I open the tent flap and invite the first person in. But until I'm ready to do that, I need to be in there with my characters. And I need to add, this is why I don't associate writing with loneliness. I don't get lonely. It's a very crowded place, usually.
Yeah, I'll bet. So tell me about your husband, Hal, in this process. I assume he is or is not in the tent.
He's not. No. Although this current book I'm working on, he actually figured it out. I couldn't believe it. I said a couple of key things, and he did a little bit of research and said, I know what you're writing about. But that's the first time he's done that. It's a long story with us that we give each other creative freedom because he's an architect who also composes music, and I write. And so our house is kind of like an artist colony, and he goes off and does his thing, and I do mine. And we talk a lot about the creative process and the challenges of that and the rewards of it. But we do so in a somewhat abstract way, because I won't say, you know, I'm stuck at the end of this chapter, or, oh, goodness, I'm throwing out those 100 pages and starting again. I'll just say, oh, boy, you know, it's sort of a downtime, and then we'll talk that through.
So, Andrew, your turn. Tell us about your creative process. What's that like?
Well, you know, I used to think that you had to sit around and wait for the muse. And when I was younger, that's very much what I did was I would sort of write whenever, you know, the muse visited me, when I'd feel creative. And as I've gotten older, I realized that that just wasn't something that was sustainable, mm-hmm. especially not for a career, because really to, you know, to be a writer, to publish, you have to, you know, do this continually. You have to go every day, you know, to your office or someplace you think of as your office, like a coffee shop or something, you know, and really treat it like a job. You have to show up there for 8 hours or whatever every single day, and then, you know, repeat this. And does the muse visit every single day? No, you know, but at least I want to be there when it does. So I'm very, you know, much more deliberate now, and Rachel said she doesn't get lonely while writing, but I do. so a lot of times while I'm writing, like I said, I'll be out at a coffee shop or something, just so that there are people around me. It kind of feels less lonely, I guess.
It's interesting contrasts and similarities, Barry. What about you? What's your creative process like?
Well, let me comment a little bit about what Rachel and Dan just said, because it illustrates, I think, the multifaceted and the mysterious and the marvelous aspects of creativity. You know, Rachel, I think one of the worst things that can happen to the creative process is that it becomes edited and people start to criticize. I think criticism is a killer. So I think what one way to protect oneself against that is don't tell anybody about what you're working on. And I think it works very, very well for a lot of people. But in contrast to that, and mysteriously, is so many creative societies like the Renaissance, like Michelangelo and Leonardo and in Elizabethan England, everybody is out there talking to everybody else and sparking ideas in everybody else, and they seem to trigger each other. Now, I don't know if when Shakespeare gets an idea for a play, if he runs off and hides it away from Marlowe so that the idea doesn't get damaged or criticized or stolen. But it's an illustration of how many mysteries there are about what is creative. For myself, I don't really consider myself a creative writer. I've edited several books. The most creative thing that I wrote was a book of poetry for my late wife during her illness and shortly after she died. And I don't really feel that I wrote that because I was impelled to write it. The ideas came to me, and I just couldn't ignore them, the ideas for the poetry and then the ideas for the prose. And I just felt that I had to put these things down on paper, and oddly enough, I think it's the best thing I've ever written, and at the same time, I felt I didn't really write it.
So, and Barry, you just said what you said about that book, and you still don't consider yourself a creative writer? Come on.
Well, the book of poetry, I think, yes, that's certainly a creative piece of work, and I wrote several chapters in the books that I edited, Creativity and Madness, Psychological Studies of Art and Artists. But, you know, I compiled works. I asked other people to contribute their chapters, and in that sense, I was editing or I was administrating the chapters that I wrote. Certainly, feel that I was creating the chapters.
Andrew, you know, Barry was just talking about criticism killing the creative process. You, in your book, Literary Rogues, you quote William S. Burroughs after lecturing students in Switzerland saying, there's a question in my mind as to whether writing can be taught. There are techniques of writing, but I don't think any writer has ever lived long enough to really discover or codify them. So can creativity be taught or just nurtured?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and I think that's, you know, with the proliferation of creative writing programs, graduate programs in the United States, it's really one that people you know, ask all the time, are we really turning out more writers here, or are we just turning out more creative writing professors? And so it's a question a lot of people have, and I think, you know, Burroughs was sort of onto, you know, the right track there, which is that we can't really, you know, we can teach you the fundamentals of writing, but by the time you get to be, you know, in your 20s and you're in grad school, there's really not a lot more you're going to, you know, learn about writing. You know all, you know, the basics of grammar and everything. You know enough, but it's like, what are you going to do with that? And I think that, you know, what teaching creative writing does is it really is, you know, it's a nurturing environment for young writers. And you really do learn as much from other writers that you're in the programs with as you do from your professors, I think.
Well, I've dragged you out unknowingly on a limb. And that's because Rachel Simon taught creative writing at Bryn Mawr for many years. So Rachel, what was your curriculum like? I mean, what did you teach?
Oh, wow. I taught a lot in terms of craft. I was pretty specific about, in my experience, things that worked and things that really didn't work and that editors would not receive very favorably. I also talked and taught about the writing process, because one of the things I think a lot of people don't understand when they sit down to write is that there's the first draft, but then there's revision, and that it's not a sign of your lack of intelligence to have to do repeated revisions. So learning your process and how it works for you as an individual at this time in your life, I came to feel was just as important as learning how to create a convincing character. So we would do both, and we would also read a lot of published works and look at them in terms of the choices the writers made for why that character was introduced this particular way or at this particular moment. And then that way we could talk about writing as sort of a fluid thing, so that students weren't just producing something and thinking, oh, it has to stay like that forever.
I'm not sure which of the three of you I want to ask this. Maybe Barry, I'll start with. So creativity, is it something we all have? Is it something few people have? Can it be taught? Can it be nurtured?
Well,
I don't know why I'm turning to you as the expert, but you're a psychiatrist, and if you don't know, you can make it up.
Well, let me have a try at the psycho jargon then. Creativity. We're all creative in some ways. We put things together. We make meals. We go on. We put trips together. We put programs together, etc. But at the higher levels of creativity, I think that everybody can learn. Most everybody can learn the craft. They can learn the techniques. They can have the tools. But I think for the very, very highest levels of creativity, I think you have to start with a lot of innate material. And, let's say that dysfunctional families are God's gift to the world of creativity, because most creativity, or a great deal of creativity, comes out of pain and suffering. And it's the artist's attempt to externalize that pain and suffering in whatever form, whether it's writing or sculpting or painting, so that there's some distance, but an attempt to create distance, and it's really an attempt, I think, to master that pain and suffering. Yeah. And when that pain and suffering is there, the artist really is driven to do that. Otherwise, it's a defense against the depression and the pain and the suffering and the suicidal impulses that go along with that kind of dysfunctional mental life.
Barry Painter, you just heard his voice. He's a psychiatrist and founder of the Creativity and Madness Conference. That's what we're talking about on today's show with Painter Rachel Simon and Andrew Schaefer. We're talking about the process of creativity and actually creativity and madness. Do we need that wounded place to create from. And we're not just talking about writing. We're talking about painting. We're talking about all sorts of creativity. Do we need that? Our number is 888-477-9499. Andrew, in your book, you know, I love the title, Literary Rogues. You reveal many things that get in the way or some that enhance creativity. You write about addictions, mental illness, misdeeds, aberrant behavior, everyone from Marquis de Sade to Hemingway to James Frey. Do you think we can be creative without demons?
I absolutely do think we can be creative without demons. I think for a long time, though, I did subscribe to the notion that, you know, to be creative, you had to have some sort of darkness to you. That if you didn't have that darkness or depression or you weren't fighting something internally, that whatever you created wouldn't be of value. And you know, over the years, I looked at the writers that I admired. They all seemed to have that sort of, you know, they lived sort of like rock stars, I thought. Like Lord Byron was very depressed, but he also did things like he drank wine out of a human skull and shotguns indoors. You know, William Burroughs, you know, did heroin just like Kurt Cobain, and they even recorded a song together. And so I always had this idea that somehow that was all sort of, you know, bundled up together, creativity, you know, darkness, depression, drug use. And as I got older, I realized that, you know, maybe that wasn't, you know, so cool. I mean, maybe rock stars, you know, aren't really the people I should be taking, you know, life advice from.
And we should have this disclaimer in here that, you know, not all creative people, not all successful creative people have mental illness or substance abuse, so on and so forth. Some of them are just mere garden variety neurotics like you and me. But, you know, I chose my words, and we'll stick with you, Andrew, for a minute. In the intro, I chose my words carefully when I said many write from broken places, and that's what you're arguing against, but the language I used was broken open. So I wonder if there does have to be a quality of wide openness and a willingness to see things differently than everybody else in your own unique way.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, unless you see things differently than other people, you're probably not going to, you know, want to go down the path of, you know, being a creative writer or, you know, or a musician or an artist or something. These are sort of, you know, anytime you use your creativity, especially in a professional sense, you're really sort of living on, you know, the margins of society. You know, if you tell your parents that you want to be a writer someday, they might kind of groan and go, oh, you know, what's your backup plan? You know, I hope you can teach English or something. And so there's already this idea that your creativity, you know, sets you apart from other people in some way. You know, it's not the way to a stable job or whatever. So that was definitely something, you know, that was on my mind when, you know, I was writing this book about literary rogues, the idea that these writers really went against society's wishes.
Yeah, and Rachel, they're all vulnerable human beings and in a way don't know how to cope with their own vulnerability. When I talked about being broken open, you nodded enthusiastically.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, it's really interesting. I've been thinking about this program as the days have been approaching and thinking, you know, is madness a necessary part of the creative process? And I don't think it is. And I think largely that's what we're saying here. But I do think most writers I've known, most creative people I've known, don't choose to kind of live on the margins of society. It's just the way they are. And there's a wide range of reasons for why that is. And It can be anything from being an immigrant to this country to being in a school where you're a different class or a different ethnic group to, in my case, being the sibling of somebody with a disability, where you're not quite like everybody else and you're aware of that. And I think just that sort of standing outside and looking at the world gives you a fresh perspective than other people have, and then you present the world as you see it.
And there's a quality of loneliness that goes with that. And I'm talking about my experience, and I wonder in my case if it wasn't as something as simple as a learning disability, that I saw the world a little bit differently. But we didn't know anything about learning disabilities back then. But, you know, there's a quality of, if not loneliness, aloneness, that differentness doesn't feel warm and fuzzy to young people. Let's take a break, and we'll come back. We've got callers on the line who want to join the conversation and so much more I want to talk about. We're talking about creativity and the demons of many creative writers. Do they have to be there? What is that creative process? My guests are Barry Panter, Rachel Simon, and Andrew Schaefer. Panter is founder of the Creativity and Madness Conference. Simon has written 6 books, including The Story of Beautiful Girl. Andrew Schaefer is author of Literary Rogues, A Scandalous History of Wayward Authors. Our phone number, and we'd love to hear from you, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about creativity in writing and painting and composing. Creativity, what is it? Where does it come from? How do we get it? What interferes with it? And what enhances it? My guests are Barry Panter. He is a psychiatrist. Rachel Simon is an award-winning author. And Andrew Schaefer, he is author of Literary Rogues, which is what inspired today's show. Listen, on our website today, we posted a video of a TED Talk about creativity by Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the mega blockbuster Eat, Pray, Love. Let's listen for a moment as she tells us why she's not happy about the reputation that writers and other creative people have earned over the years.
To be fair, right, chemical engineers as a group, you know, haven't really earned a reputation over the centuries for being alcoholic manic depressives. And we writers, you know, we kind of do have that reputation. And not just writers, but creative people across all genres, it seems, have this reputation for being enormously mentally unstable. And, you know, all you have to do is look at the very grim death count in the 20th century alone of really magnificent creative minds who died young and often at their own hands, you know. And even the ones who didn't literally commit suicide seemed to be really undone by their gifts, you know. Norman Mailer, just before he died, last interview, he said, "Every one of my books has killed me a little more." an extraordinary statement to make about your life's work, you know, but we don't even blink when we hear somebody say this because we've heard that kind of stuff for so long, and somehow we've completely internalized and accepted collectively this notion that creativity and suffering are somehow inherently linked, and that artistry, in the end, will always ultimately lead to anguish. And the question that I want to ask everybody here today is, are you guys all cool with that idea? Like, are you comfortable with that? Because you look at it even from an inch away, and, you know, I'm not at all comfortable with that assumption. I think it's odious, and I also think it's dangerous, and I don't want to see it perpetuated into the next century. I think better if we encourage, you know, our great creative minds to live.
That was author Elizabeth Gilbert speaking at a recent TED conference. To watch the full TED talk, go to whyy.org/voices, where we will have much more information about creativity, about this show. Rachel Simon's webpage will be up there. That has been revised, I am told. Barry, I want to turn to you here as a psychiatrist. Do you agree with Elizabeth Gilbert?
Well, no, I don't. But I think she's taking issue with the hyperbole that has gone along with that statement. I think we all have our emotional issues, and we all struggle with them and try to work them out in a constructive way. That's what I think artists do. And they do it in a way that is a great contribution to society, but they are struggling. And when the struggle is successful, we end up with a wonderful contribution to our lives, to our culture. But when they struggle unsuccessfully, it often does lead to their demise. As Elizabeth said, the rate of suicide among creative artists is tremendous. It's a high-risk profession for many people. But to classify all artists as being suicidal or mad or alcoholic is the hyperbole of it. They all struggle with their issues, as we all do. And their struggles are out there on the page or on the painting or in the sculpture.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Michael on the line. Hey, Michael.
Hello. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
I just wanted to comment, basically, you know, I am a professional photographer for a living. That's what I do now. I've been in the corporate world before, but gave that up. And I also happen to be 23 years sober. I believe that to some extent, there are a lot of creative people, especially in the 12-step programs that I've been in. And I think to be truly creative, you have to be able to see the world from a different point of view. I know that when I was drinking, I was not able to create anything. But since I quit drinking, I created, you know, more and more. For a brief stint, I wrote poetry, which, I'll be honest with you, probably was horrible. But being able to create, I think, comes from a unique look at the world, and sometimes that also comes from the pain of seeing the world in a way that is not necessarily considered socially acceptable.
Michael, that pain, do you think that predated your alcoholism?
Probably. Yeah. I started drinking at a very young age. I was only about 12. So it's hard to say, but I always felt that I didn't fit. And just one of the ways I fit in doing the chameleon thing was by drinking, because with drinking I could be a life of the party, or I could be the badass of the party, or I could be just different, and I didn't have to be myself. Yet when I came to peace with that, I was able to find an outlet through photography that allows me to, in some ways, isolate myself, in other ways, bury myself in a crowd. I specialize in architectural and portrait photography, so they're both extremes. I mean, one, you're trying to herd cats when you're shooting, you know, a lot of models or something like that. But when you're shooting architecture, you're sitting patiently, quietly, usually alone, waiting for the light. So it allows me both ends of my personality.
Yeah, that's a wonderful endeavor. I really appreciate the call, and you brought up an important issue that I want to turn to Barry Yu about. That Andrew suggested in his book, and I'm inclined to agree, that much alcohol and drug abuse comes from the writers he profiles in his book is because these people are suffering and they're self-medicating. So, you know, I wonder about, you know, the link between bipolar disorder, this mania that, you know, we see some of the most prolific writers, Balzac, for example, would write 15 hours sometimes without a break. He produced 79 novels in 12 years. So do you think a lot of the drug and alcohol use is about self-medicating, suffering?
Yes, yes, of course, I think it is. It's an attempt to relieve the pain. You know, I came across a very interesting article a little while ago talking about creativity and the bipolar disorder in particular. And the author, I forget where I read it, but the author made the point that why has bipolar disorder existed and continues? Why does it continue in our society and in mankind? And the answer that he proposes is that bipolar disorder is adaptive. And the way that it is adaptive is that when people are depressed, of course, if they're totally depressed, very severely depressed, they're not doing anything. But as they begin to emerge out of that depression and kick off into the manic phase, as you were describing with Balzac, and Schumann wrote his first symphony in 3 days without sleep, you know, the examples are on and on. But it's the reversal of the depression and arising into the mania where that creative burst takes place. And that's good for society. That's how advances are made.
Well, and yet, suicide rate's quite high with bipolar disorder.
Well, those are the failed attempts at working through the process, the problems. You know, Elizabeth was talking about creativity leads to depression and suicide and alcoholism. I would take issue with that. It doesn't lead to that. Creativity is the attempt to escape from that.
Rachel, you've got your own history of depression. I happen to know from an earlier conversation that you spoke to Marty Moss Cohen about it many, many, many,
many years ago, 1990.
Ago. So tell us about your own depression and how that blends with your creativity or interferes with.
Yeah, I think I need to jump in and say I, in my case, I decided to be a writer long before I ever dealt with depression. I decided when I was 7, I started working on my writing when I was a little kid, you know, pretty much soon after that. And it wasn't until I was later on in my teen years that I had what I would now call depression, even though I was never formally diagnosed, and then into my 20s and episodes where I couldn't get out of bed, that kind of thing. But my love of writing was, I didn't really see it as being intertwined with the depression. In fact, the depression held me back from it at times, or, you know, would just get in my way. And I think a key thing that I want to bring up that is kind of the opposite of what you said earlier about loneliness being at the starting point for many creative people, I think it's really a helping hand. Or someone who praises you. When I was a little kid, I had a father who really believed in me and would say very complimentary things and would praise my writing and praise me for writing, even if later in life he preferred I was going to be a lawyer, but still at that age. And that made me believe in myself. And then when I got into my 20s and was with the man I'm now married to, Hal, he was so incredibly encouraging. And so I think that it was the encouragement that helped me move on from the depression. It wasn't the writing. And now what I do, which ties in with this substance abuse stuff that we've been talking about, I'm a heavy-duty, healthy person. I work out a lot every day. I eat very healthy. People who know me know this is a very major part of my life. And I look at having the machine be clean and healthy as being part of the creative process. I look at depression and drinking and smoking and all that other stuff as a way for people to clog themselves and to make it more difficult.
Yeah. However, I wonder about generalizations, and I'll tell you why I bring that up. Rachel, we've got Martin on the line who might want to talk about that spectrum issue. Hey, Martin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
A couple of comments and kind of interweaves in Rachel's comments and Michael's comments. My first thought was that the image of the tormented artist, you know, is it really is a caricature. It's a cartoon image, and in my experience, both personally and observing contemporary artists, I find that they, like everybody else, bridge the full spectrum of people, both tormented on the one hand and demons swirling about them, and on the other side, very businesslike, very logical, and you know, non-destructive individuals. Let's say the pop artists from the 60s. I think most of those guys were the opposite, and not just in their content and the message they were sending in response to the abstract expressionists, but in their manner. I mean, Warhol was a businessman. Lichtenstein was he was like a family guy. He was very well adjusted. He was the opposite of this cartoon that we hear about.
Yeah, I appreciate your perspective. I really do. It's important. So creative people are on the spectrum, just kind of like the rest of us humans, huh? Martin, thanks so much for your call. Rachel, you had a comment?
Yeah, I want to agree with that. I think it's right on. And I also just want to jump in and say, I think that this whole image of the tortured artist is not only somewhat older, but it's really male. And you rarely associate that tortured, drinking, depressed, acting out artist with females. And I really, really like Andrew's book, but there were very, very few women included in this book. And I think that as women have become more in the arts, more actively in the arts, that makes things a little bit different and changes the equation.
All right, my dear friend. Then I want to talk about one of the women, Andrew, in your book, Elizabeth Wurtzel. Her writing career began as a teenager when she was published in 17 magazine. As an undergraduate, she wrote for the Harvard Crimson, and it seemed to skyrocket from there. At the same time, she was battling a pretty severe depression that she had when she was 12 or 13. She tried antidepressants and therapy, and they helped, so she wrote Prozac Nation.
Yeah, that's correct. And I just want to jump in for a second and say that I completely agree with what, Rachel, your comments about the women and the lack of women in the book. And Elizabeth Wurtzel was one of the very few females that actually made it into the book. Part of that has to do with, I think, just how Western society has treated women in the past, and they didn't really have a lot of leeway to sort of act out in the same way that a lot of these guys did. I think, you know, society and culture gave them a lot more leeway. So when you have someone like Elizabeth Wurtzel come along, and and she wrote this memoir that was incredibly popular, Prozac Nation, about her battle with she talked about her own creativity and her depression in there. And when she started talking about drinking and drugs and some of the same stuff that, you know, you associate with sort of the more of the macho male writers over the years, people sort of, there were a lot of people that took offense at that and said, oh, this is just unseemly or something. I'm like, really? Well, it's not much different than, you know, what Hunter S. Thompson was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, we are changing. But But over the years, it definitely, it's been a very macho image, that very, that Hemingway sort of image of, you know, Hemingway famously said, write drunk, edit sober. But actually, he didn't say that. it was attributed to him just because we have this idea of Hemingway, and he really did nothing to dispel, you know, people's mm-hmm. people's image of him.
Well, we've got to take a short break. We've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation. I also want to know about, you know, now that we're talking about depression and bipolar disorder, you know, a lot of creative people I've treated over the years are frightened of these medications, fearful that it will inhibit their own creativity. So I want to talk to psychiatrist Barry Panter about that. We're talking about creativity and whether we need a dark side to be creative or not. Like I said, my guests are Barry Panter, psychiatrist, founder of Creativity and Madness Conference, Rachel Simon, award-winning author, her including the New York Times bestseller Story of Beautiful Girl, and humorist Andrew Schaffer, author of Literary Rogues, A Scandalous History of Wayward Authors. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. The new healthcare law is here, and Independence Blue Cross can help consumers understand how the new law affects individuals and families. Independence Blue Cross has been here for 75 years, and they're committed to being here for whatever lies ahead. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. To find out more about how the healthcare law could affect you, details at ibx.com.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about the creative process and trying to understand it a bit better with psychiatrist Barry Panter and, I guess, authors, writers, professional writers, Rachel Simon and Andrew Schaffer. Before a break, Barry, I talked about so many people are fearful of taking antidepressants or mood stabilizers for bipolar disorder for fear it will inhibit that creative process. What's your take?
Well, I think the artist intuitively, unconsciously, subconsciously knows that it's the struggle that helps the creativity, the struggle against the inner demons. And, of course, the demons are creating so much suffering that the artist would love to get rid of the demons, but the artist is also fearful of driving out that the medications, the psychotherapy, the psychoanalysis will drive out the angels as well. So in working with a creative artist, it is extremely important, and it's a very, very delicate balance to try not to disrupt the creative process and not to do anything to damage it. And because in my opinion, the creative art, the creative writing, the creative impulse, the creative spark is so intertwined with the demons, it's very, very difficult to avoid damaging that creative process. And I think artists are appropriately fearful that therapy, medication will disturb that or destroy it.
Yeah, I must say, Barry, you know, I'm not a physician and I don't prescribe, but my take is a bit different. And my first priority is helping people take care of their brains, because everything else falls into place after that. And I'm just concerned about the level of suffering, not just for themselves, but for their families. And I personally have faith that, you know, a creative heart, soul, mind will find its way to speak. I mean, that's, you know, that's in our evolutionary genes for millions of years. So, you know, two different mental health professionals and two different takes. Let's go to the phones. We've got Tom on the line.
Yes. Hello.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah, I want to shed a little bit more light on the discussion. I don't think that it's necessary to have a dark side or to be creative. I don't think that all creativity arises from suffering. Look at children. I have grandchildren, and sometimes I'm amazed at their creativity. And I think that the creativity arises out of playfulness and curiosity. I'm an adult, and I think that I'm often creative when I'm playful. And when I wonder, what would happen if? Sometimes it gets me in trouble, but I have also experienced creativity arising out of depression. But I wouldn't say that all creativity does.
Yeah, I want to hear, Andrew, your take, and Rachel, yours on what Tom said about about how curiosity and playfulness could also be a birthplace.
That's definitely. He might be right when he says there might be, you know, more than one, you know, birthplace of creativity, because you know, some of the most creative, you know, acts that I've ever witnessed have been with improv groups. You know, if you've ever been to a comedy improv show, and the stuff that people come to off the top of their head by asking the questions, what if, what if, what if, there's definitely a very playful place that you can get to that you can derive your creativity from. So I definitely do agree that there's, you know, I think there's more than sort of one way to get at creativity.
Rachel?
I'm in complete agreement with Andrew and Tom. And hi, Tom, I know you. I think bringing up the example of children and play is really very enlightening for everybody who's listening to this, because it makes us realize creativity can precede suffering. It can happen during suffering. It can happen after suffering. And what do the Buddhists say? All of life is suffering, or something like that. So I think we have to figure, well, okay, if we're all going to suffer, maybe we can all also be creative. And sometimes it happens before, and sometimes after, and sometimes during.
Yeah, it's interesting, Rachel. You said if we're all going to suffer, maybe we can be creative. Barry, I'm thinking of a comment you mentioned earlier about dysfunctional families. And I remember it was a New Yorker cartoon many, many years ago where there was a man sitting alone in a room with many chairs. And the caption under it was, a meeting of people with functional families.
So, I agree totally with Rachel and with Andrew about the value of play, and I think the creativity of children is a joy. It enriches our lives just to watch it. But children, as far as their creativity, they haven't learned all the rules yet, and so of course they're going to come up with different ways of doing things because they haven't had imposed on them the rules that you gain and that you learn as you get older in life. So children find new ways of doing things. And, of course, what is that? That's creativity.
I want to bring up something else. We've got a caller who I don't think we're going to have time to get on the line, but I do want to mention what she was concerned about and want to hear you weigh in on that. She said, no one's talked about genetics. What's the role of genetics? I'm a case in point. I come from artists. Art runs in families, and we've all seen that. So what about the role of genetics? Barry, we'll start with you.
I'm sorry, I don't have a very good connection. I didn't hear the word. What is the role of what?
Genetics.
Oh, genetic.
In creativity.
Ah, well, that's a very, very interesting question, and I think maybe the neuroscientists are going to be weighing in on this in the next decade or so. I can only think of the examples of some families, of course, the Bach family, the Strauss family, that is it by imitation? Is it by example? This is what you do when you get older? or is there something in those brain cells, some substance, some way of transmitting that substance from one cell to another, some way of receiving the perception and processing it? So, in conclusion, I don't know. But I think neuroscientists will tell us a lot in the future.
I've seen it, and everyone has seen that it does run in families. Another caller said that she came from a creative family, gave her son up for adoption, and many years later, he's turned out to be an artist also. So, you know, you're right. It's a really interesting question, but you know, it comes back to the question I asked in the beginning of the show, and I'll turn to you, Rachel. Can it be taught? Can it be nurtured? And how so?
I'm so glad you returned to that question, because I was sitting here thinking that. I actually think everybody's creative in one way or another, in many ways. And it's not so much do we teach creativity, it's do we nurture it in the area the person's interested in, and does the person come to that area with sufficient passion? When I was teaching, what I used to say to my students is, I can teach you craft, I can't teach you passion. And I think along with that is ambition and a tip of the hat to Andrew Humer. Those are things that can't be taught.
Yeah, and you're right. Passion can't be taught. And your point in your class really underscores my point when I interview many of my patients. And I ask the question, what's your dream? Not your goal, but what's your dream? Because I need to believe there's passion in there, or there was at one point. And it can be accessed when we know about dreams. So many people in today's fast-moving world have goals, but not dreams, and that saddens me quite a bit. Unfortunately, one of my dreams is to have a much longer show to really, really talk more about creativity, but we can't. So I want to thank all three of you. It's been a really fascinating show. My guests have been Barry Panter, a psychiatrist, Rachel Simon, award-winning author, Andrew Schaefer, also a wonderful author of Literary Rogues. I highly recommend it. Well, we've been talking about creativity. Next week, we're going to be talking about children of domestic violence. We'd like to hear from you. We're at voices.org/voices. We're also at Twitter at Voices in the Fam. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn's our producer. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.